We're going to move the schedule around a little bit, and we're going to spend our time on a public hearing on Senate Bill 160 today. We may or may not get to the work session on the other two bills. One of them has an amendment, and we're going to have to mess around with that for a while. But I'd like to concentrate on Senate Bill 160. So with that, Reese Sailors, Jim Edge, and Wally Schaefer. Please come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette and Senator Berger. For the record, my name is Reese Sailors. I am the Health Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski, and I'm here to, on behalf of the Governor, to ask you to support this legislation. I think this is an important piece of legislation to the governor and to the people of Oregon for many reasons. Some people would say it's because of the savings that are included in the governor's budget, but I would say it's because it's about the quality of health care. And we are very anxious and very strong in our support of evidence-based medicine. And the PDL used by DHS is an evidence-based formulary. I think what's important is that we continue in every way possible as a state, as we deal with healthcare issues, to support evidence-based practices. And in this case, the effort is to get the right drug to patients, the most effective drug to the patients, and not necessarily the best advertised drug to the patient. This is based on science that takes advantage of knowledge across the globe, not just here in Oregon and not just in the United States. It will still allow physicians to ultimately decide the appropriate treatment for their patients. And it also provide physicians with information along the way that's based on the scientific reviews. It does not and will not stop a patient from getting effective medication. And it will not disrupt patients who are stabilized on medications that are not on the PDL. Those are reasons based that support quality of care and good, sound, evidence-based medical practice. In addition to that, the advantage that we get by adopting this legislation is that it does afford savings in the neighborhood of $8 million in the first biennium and $15 million in the second biennium. In addition, it provides us as a state with better leverage to negotiate secondary rebates with manufacturers, which is sorely needed, particularly in the wake of the implementation of Part D, where states as a whole lost a lot of their bargaining clout because of the federal government coming in and covering a lot of the drugs. So it's important for us to be able to regain some of the leverage in order to negotiate good secondary rebates. And when we do that, that means it's money coming into the state to help defray the cost of health care further. Finally, this type of legislation and the tools that are represented in this bill are kind of a standard, very routinely used tools in the private sector. We're not asking to do anything different from what's done by every major carrier in the state and every major carrier in the country, by every major hospital. Every one of the hospitals has a formulary that they work off of. What's nice about ours is that we can have confidence that it is based in evidence. And I'd also like to point out in closing and then let the technical experts talk to you, but given the fact that we have devoted ourselves to the policy of evidence-based medicine, it's possible that some of the drug studies may indeed point to a drug that is not the least expensive. That the most effective drug would be more expensive than others, and we still will choose that drug because it is the most effective and it is scientifically proven to be so. So I think that's an important thing. The final word that I'd say is that I know that there is some concern about mental health drugs, and I'd like to talk to you as a consumer. I'm someone who takes mental health drugs every day of my life and who has a family that many members of which take these drugs. What I have found is that getting the right mental health drug is very important. However, whether or not you have a formulary or not has nothing to do with getting that matched. It has to do with finding the chemistry in your body and the chemistry in a drug and matching the two up so that they work together well. It doesn't have to do with whether or not you have to call and get prior authorization. It has to do with getting that match made. And I think what I've seen in my own experience, and also I have just recently come here, as you may know, from the state of Washington. What we have seen in Washington is that this has not caused terrible problems to the people who have mental health problems. So I would feel very comfortable as a consumer telling you that this is the best way to go for people who have mental illness. I would pose the question, relative to mental health drugs, is why would I not want the best available science to guide my physician and me in our decisions? That's what this bill offers to us. I urge you to pass this bill out favorably, and I'll be happy to respond to any questions you may have. Thank you.
If there is an advertisement, thank you very much for your testimony. If there's an advertisement on the nightly news on a red-hot new mental health drug, and people rush out and want to buy it, and they call in and say, we want this drug, how do you deal with that?
Well, I think any drug, you don't just get to call in and get any drug. A physician has to prescribe that drug for you, and a physician has to make the judgment about whether or not they believe that drug is appropriate for you. I would hope that physicians would make that decision based on a combination of science and their experience in dealing in the field.
Let me try to rephrase your question because I think I said it wrong.
Okay.
Okay. Detail people go to the physician, say, this is a hot new drug. You ought to use it. It's advertised on television. Got lots of demands for it. Is there any evidence based before examination, before you allow them to switch to, okay, pre-authorization. They call in and they say, we want this drug. It's not authorized. It's a brand new drug. Have you had a chance to check it out yet? Are you going to allow them to get a drug that hasn't been checked out according to the evidence-based formulary that you use or evidence-based method that you use?
Actually, I think I'll let my technical people talk to you about that.
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Jim Edge. I'm the interim administrator for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. My first day in that role, so I'm trying to get it to slide smoothly off my tongue, and it's not working quite yet, but it'll get there. Chair Morissette, in answer, specific answer to your question, the tool of prior authorization is a tool to have the physician call and explain to us why he would like to use a particular drug that's not on the preferred list, that's a non-preferred drug. The only occasion where we envision not paying for that drug would be if it's for a condition that's below the line on the prioritized list of health services. If the physician has a reason to use a non-preferred drug, we would then allow the physician to prescribe that drug. We just want the opportunity to tell the physician that there is a preferred drug, many times at a lower cost.
Well, let me ask again about at what point do you subject that new drug to your investigation in terms of evidence?
Chair Morissette, the drugs are looked at in classes, and the studies, the evidence-based studies are done in classes of drugs. And We evaluate and do the evidence-based studies on a class of drugs that all have similar effectiveness, or that all have similar effects. And the evidence-based studies, actually I should be letting Dr. Schaefer talk about this, he's more the expert on it, but the evidence-based studies come to the Health Resources Commission, which he was the chair of before he came to work for DHS. And it's only after those studies are done of classes of drugs and a drug, either a clear superior drug comes out of the evidence-based studies or it's determined that they're equally effective. And then a decision would be made to identify a preferred drug.
Chair Morissette, the other thing is that the Health Resources Commission periodically re-reviews drug classes. Just for that very reason, when new drugs come onto the market, there are times when the drug class is reviewed again to look at the evidence based on the fact that there are new entrants into the marketplace. So those evidence-based reviews are done periodically, and they are updated periodically also by the Health Resources Commission.
Okay. Did I interrupt the flow of your...
No, sir. I was finished.
You were finished. Okay.
Thank you.
Jim,
Yes, Chair Morissette. I would just like to reiterate some of what Ree already said, in that what we are asking for in this bill is the ability to use a tool, the tool of prior authorization, to encourage better compliance with our planned drug list, with our evidence-based planned drug list. We're not expecting to do a lot of denials when these prior authorizations are given. In fact, the only circumstance under which we envision denials would be if a drug is being prescribed for a below-the-line medical condition. But we want the opportunity to be able to tell a physician that there is a preferred drug, if there is one, in the class of drugs that he's requesting. And we would like to be able to encourage a shift in prescribing patterns if the physician is willing to do that. There's two ways that the savings occurs. The $8 million savings that Ree referred to that would occur in a 12-month period in the next biennium, and then the following biennium in a 24-month period, it would be a $15 million savings. That savings occurs in part because of the shift in market share to the less expensive drugs. It also occurs because the manufacturers are willing to enter into negotiations to give supplemental rebates to the state of Oregon when we can have a planned drug list with a prior authorization that causes a market shift in prescribing patterns. It's interesting to look back and realize that Oregon was the first state to implement an evidence-based planned drug list. In fact, I think Senator Cruz was one of the sponsors of that bill back in 2001. Other states have followed suit behind us, and currently there are 42 of the 50 states using evidence-based planned drug lists. Oregon is the only one that has a statutory prohibition against using a tool like prior authorization to get better compliance with the plan drug list. The other states allow that. The other states have, in many cases, entered together into multi-state consortiums and entered into those rebate negotiations to get rebates from the drug manufacturers on the drugs on their plan drug list.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can you cite the savings that the other states have had compared to the savings that we've had with their prior authorization?
Mr. Chair and Senator Moss Anderson, I don't have that information in front of me, but we can get that for you. Yes, that's available.
And is it significantly more from the other states who have prior authorization?
Yes, it is. And some of the speakers who will follow can discuss a study that was done even in Oregon when we implemented prior authorization for a short period of time before it was statutorily prohibited, when our compliance with the planned drug list shifted considerably, and then when the statutory prohibition went into effect, it shifted back. And so there's actual evidence in Oregon about to what happens when the tool of prior authorization is allowed.
Follow-up just yes. And are we talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars?
Chair Morissette, Senator Moss-Anderson, we're talking about millions of dollars.
Thank you.
I think I will let Dr. Schaefer, our medical director, talk a little bit about the details of how this plan works and give a little summary of the process.
I have two microphones.
Somebody has either a cell phone or a BlackBerry on, and that kind of reverberates through our system. So if you...
It's not me.
Thank you.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Walter Schaefer. I'm the medical director of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. The state of Oregon has developed a great process for evaluating the effectiveness and safety of medications. And as Jim Edge mentioned, I had the privilege of serving as the chair of the Health Resources Commission that does those reviews that form the basis for the planned drug list. I was on the Health Resources Commission up until about a year ago when I took my current job. Over the years of going through this process, the process has developed a fair amount of credibility and respect amongst physicians and pharmacists in the state and really across the country for being objective, unbiased reviews that are not based on cost, but just on the relative effectiveness and safety of the drugs. The process that was started in Oregon has subsequently become a multi-state process involving about 15 states directly in the Drug Effectiveness Review Project, but many other states use the information. So it is kind of ironic that Oregon has developed this really excellent system for evaluating drugs, but has no effective way to enforce the choices that are made out of the process. Many other states are now using the system that Oregon started, and Oregon actually funded the initial studies on the drugs. But as Jim mentioned, Oregon's the only state that's statutorily prohibited from enforcing the drug list by prior authorization.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Doctor, how many states are you talking about now? Oregon is the only state not having.
There are 42 states that now have a planned drug list for their Medicaid program.
And they do not allow prior, and they have a prior authorization.
And they have prior authorization.
Okay.
They aren't prohibited from doing prior authorization.
Okay.
As we are.
42 states.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you give us something in writing on that, please?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, I'll submit that in writing. Let me just tell you a little bit more about how the prior authorization is intended to work in Oregon so that it doesn't impair access to needed medications. Clients that are stable on medications that are not on the planned drug list will be able to continue, so they'll be grandfathered in. So we're talking about prior authorization for new starts or for changes in medication. If a physician wants to prescribe a non-listed drug, a single phone call will be all that's needed, and approval of alternative medications will be determined primarily by whether it's being used for a diagnosis that's above the funding line on the prioritized list. Let me talk a little bit about mental health drugs, because I know that's an issue. As pointed out in the previous answers, the same process of objective comparison of effectiveness and safety can be used with mental health drugs as with other types of drugs, comparing the results of controlled clinical trials. And that's the process that's used in other states that have mental health drugs on their planned drug list. Health Resources Commission panels will still meet to discuss the mental health drugs. Experts in the field will be included in those panels, just like we have done for other drug classes. What does vary in the process is what clinical criteria are used to turn the medical evidence into the list that's on the drugs. So if you that's the list that's on the drugs that are on the list. So if you have a fairly straightforward category of drugs like cholesterol-lowering medications where there's a fairly uniform response from person to person, you may not need as much variety on the list. Whereas if you have a category of medications like for migraine headaches, there's more individual response from one person as compared with another, so you may need a greater variety of drugs on the list. And mental health conditions may be similar. There may be more variation in response of individuals, but you can still use the same process to determine which are the most effective and safest drugs. So I think that as long as the system has the flexibility and uses mental health advisors, we will assure that people have access to the drugs that they need. DMAP and the Addictions and Mental Health Division already use a panel of advisors for mental health drugs now, and we'll continue that process. And as you'll hear today, Senate Bill 160 has gathered support from the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, the Oregon State Pharmacists Association and Pharmacy Coalition, First Health Services Corporation, which is DMAP's pharmacy benefits manager, and the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Program Directors. So what the supporters see in this planned drug list system is an evidence-based, unbiased process of drug selection, a system with enough flexibility so that unique patient needs can be met, and a prior authorization system with a minimum of administrative burden. So thank you for your attention, and answer other questions.
Yes, Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so that I really understand exactly what you're doing here, I'm a doctor and I have a list, a formulary, so I would know what was on the list and not on the list. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. So I call for pre-authorization because I want to use a drug that's not on the list. Who do I talk to?
You'll talk to a staff member. I'm not sure I can actually give you the details of where that staff member would be, but the primary question that will be asked is whether is the condition for which the drug is being prescribed. If it's determined that that condition is above the funding line on the prioritized list, then exceptions will be granted.
But I'm not talking, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
But I'm not speaking with a medical professional necessarily.
Senator Berger, that's true in the initial step of the process. However, if the exception is not allowed, the way we currently handle those exception questions is basically the question comes to me as medical director of DMAP or to one of my staff, and it is evaluated by a physician if need be, if that type of review is needed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How long did we have prior authorization initiated by the governor? That was, I think it was in the 01, after the 01 session, and it lasted, I think, till into part of the 03 session. And what evidence do we have based on that experience that it worked or didn't work?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, you will be hearing from some testimony following ours from a study that was done of that period of time, and they will give the details of that information. It was actually written up and published in a journal about Oregon's experience and the fact that there was prior authorization in place for a few months, and then that prior authorization was statutorily prohibited. And it was an excellent study for medical professionals to look at what happened during that time, the savings that occurred, the shift in prescribing patterns that occurred, And there will be subsequent testimony shortly after ours that will go through that article and identify what that information is.
The key issue, and I'm referring to Senator Berger's question, that what you told me is part of what I wanted to know. The process is what I'm concerned about also, or want to know about. Now, were there any glitches? Did when the physician called in, did he talk to someone that didn't know what they were talking about? I can remember one of the senators arguing against this process on the floor of the Senate, and he said, you know, talked about how difficult it was, how much time it took, and so on and so forth. And I'm wondering if we have any indication in terms of how well the process worked.
Senator Morissette, there will be testimony this afternoon also by an employee of the pharmacy benefits coordinator that we contract with to do this process for us. And he can describe the bank of individuals that are some pharmacists and pharmacy technicians that receive those phone calls, that ask those questions, and that give the response back to the physician. Our thought is to make this as least cumbersome as possible, to make it a very simple process of one phone call. The phone is always answered quickly. The response is given quickly. We're just asking for the opportunity to check and make sure it's not a below-the-line condition that's being prescribed for, and make sure that the prescriber is aware that if he's asking for, he or she is asking for a non-preferred drug, that there is a preferred drug available. We don't anticipate denying those. In fact, we anticipate grandfathering in people that are already established, especially on the mental health drugs, that people that are established on those. And we don't anticipate anything like what's sometimes called a fail-first policy, where you have to go through a series of drugs before you can prescribe the more expensive drugs. We're not anticipating implementing something like that. We are just asking for one phone call to be made, and we will make the approvals.
Now, Senator Berger, yes. Does that help answer the question that you
yes,
asked?
Yes, I think it does. I think the problem that I have is in your testimony. You said we want an opportunity to explain that there is another drug. Well, obviously, the person calling in, the doctor, already knows that. So I wondered why that was in your testimony.
Well, Senator Morissette, Senator Berger, the prescriber who's calling in should know that. I think not in all cases do they know that. And especially in cases such as Senator Morissette mentioned early in the testimony, where there's been a lot of advertising of a particular drug. It's something that that people are interested in because of having seen it advertised. They go in and they ask for that specific drug from their physician. It might be some cases like that, or some cases where the physician isn't carrying a copy of our preferred list around in his pocket, although we do have pocket-sized small cards that have our preferred list on them. But in many cases, In many cases, physicians are not carrying that around and may or may not be thinking about whether something is a preferred drug when they prescribe it.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Yes. Chair. Yes. I guess the other comment that I would make, and I mean this just as a way of getting information, and that is that I often feel like we get what we pay for, and I think this $8 million savings to me is, my goodness, we really are doing things wrong. So that's a pretty big number to hand out to me and have me satisfied. I can't imagine the system right now being that wrong. But I'm open. I have not certainly made some kind of narrow decision here, but I would have to have someone prove that to me.
Senator Morissette and Senator Berger, we also will be supplying you with testimony, written testimony, from the state of Washington, from their Medicaid pharmacy program. They actually had hoped to be able to come down and testify for us in Oregon. They weren't able to do that, but they sent a letter and some supportive documents. And they actually have said that they achieved $34 million in savings through the use of prior authorization in the state of Washington. And copies of that will be given to you.
Reed, did you want to?
Yes.
There's noise going on over our speaker system. Somebody has their BlackBerry on. Check your neighbor's pocket.
Pat each other down,
please.
Chair Morissette and Senator Berger, the one thing about the $8 million, I think the other thing is to understand, too, that the most frequently purchased drugs by the states, by the Oregon Health Plan, the largest volume in terms of dollars are, for instance, mental health drugs. So it's the number one prescribed classes of drugs have to do with mental illness. That's also the case in the state employees program and in a lot of commercial plans as well, too. So it's the volume as much as the savings that helps make that $8 million up.
Senator Morissette, Senator Berger, educational efforts to educate physicians about the planned drug list only go so far, and I do have copies of this pocket guide for you if you want them. But it lists all the drugs that are on the Oregon Health Plan drug list, but we only achieve a certain amount of effectiveness, and currently about 75% of the drugs that are prescribed from are on the preferred drug list, but we're hoping to increase the percentage to 90%, and that's actually what the these estimates of cost savings are based on. Just that amount of change will result in significant savings. When a so-called soft prior authorization system was enforced for those few months in 2003, use of planned drug list drugs went from 58% of prescriptions dispensed to 82% after the prior authorization rule was implemented. So just having the effect of the prior authorization, which is primarily a sentinel effect. If doctors know that they have to call to get it approved, they tend to think twice and write prescriptions for medications that are on the approved list.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Give me a third chance here.
Okay. Thank you. You just told me I had missed my chance, so I appreciate you recircling on this. What classes of drugs will be targeted for prior authorization?
Well, Senator Cruz, on the plan drug list, currently about 21 classes of drugs have been evaluated by the Health Resources Commission and recommendations made for the for inclusion on the plan drug list. So. So potentially more than 20 classes of drugs could be subject to prior authorization. We'll only do the prior authorization in those situations where it makes sense to do it, where there are choices of medications and where there is a cost benefit to requiring the prior authorization. So,
further questions?
Yes.
Thank you. What cost savings of your matrix at this point are attributed to prior authorization of mental health drugs? What of your $8 million or whatever it was?
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz. On our savings matrix, we have identified that $3.1 million of that amount would come from the prior authorization of mental health drugs.
Okay. Additional question? Okay. Is there another way that prior authorization saves money other than denying the physician the drug of first choice and giving him a lower cost medication?
Senator Morsett and Senator Cruz, yes, there are two components to the savings. One is to shift prescribing to preferred drugs, which often are less expensive, and the other is the supplemental rebates that can be negotiated by the state of Oregon, or as other states are doing, sometimes in multi-state consortiums, as they use the tool of prior authorization with a preferred drug list, and they are able then to use the purchasing power of purchasing larger amounts of drugs to negotiate larger supplemental rebates from the manufacturers, which comes back to the state Medicaid programs in those states.
And Mr. Chairman,
the $8 million
that's still, tied to going to you're basically saying, see if I got this right, for condition X, if you can get more people onto drug Y, then you can get a better rebate. Is that what you're saying?
Senator Morsett, Senator Cruz, yes, that's one of the savings.
Okay. Ms. Cherry, I guess, you know, because we did this bill, all the language being eliminated here was part of the agreement in 2001. And it's quite simply, I made statements on the floor of the House, as did Senator Bates, and it was agreed to by Governor Kitzhaber that we would create this list so that physicians could make a more informed choice. But we also all agreed that we weren't going to stand in the way of the doctor-patient relationship, and that's one of the things that this does.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I really tend to disagree with that, because physicians, in working with physicians, they actually can't be keeping up to date on all of the drugs all of the time. They cannot be looking up in the PDR for every new drug that comes in. And if you can make a call to someone who's done the research and has the evidence based, that in a sense is an extreme help to a physician.
Could you talk a minute about the drugs that would not be covered, such as HIV, cancer, so on?
Senator Morsett, the drugs that this would apply to, the calculations that we've done of savings, is the classes of drugs that have been studied and that a preferred drug has been established for. What you're referring to is the fact that there was at one point an exclusion for some drugs, some types of drugs, from the entirely from the planned drug list, and those were for cancer drugs, HIV drugs, and mental health drugs. That exclusion has sunsetted. We don't anticipate that there would be an evidence-based study of HIV drugs. There's not a group of similar drugs that would lend itself to an evidence-based study, and the same is basically true of the cancer drugs. There are a couple of classes within the mental health drugs that it's possible we might be looking at an evidence-based study of a couple of groups of those drugs. In fact, I should let Dr. Schaefer talk more about that. He's more the expert in that.
Senator Morsett, I'm not sure I have that much more to add. I think that the other states and the multi-state drug effectiveness review project have reviewed some of the classes of mental health drugs, but Oregon has not been involved in those reviews because we have been prohibited from having the mental health drugs on the planned drug list. So I think it would be a matter of looking at the evidence and doing these comparisons of effectiveness and safety in the categories of antidepressants and antipsychotic medications, and seeing if it lends itself to listing, seeing if those categories lend themselves to listing on the planned drug list. But I agree, the cancer, anti-cancer drugs and the HIV drugs do not appear to be categories of medications that would be appropriate for this type of selection.
Okay. Unless there are more questions. Thank you very much. Dr. Lace? Dr. Lace has to leave at 4 o'clock, and it's almost 4, so we'll... Thank you very much for your testimony.
You're welcome. Senator Barnstead, members of the committee, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician from Salem. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 160. Just to answer some of the questions, I'm still a practicing physician. We go through the PA process on a daily basis. We work with multiple insurance companies, commercial carriers. We work with the Oregon Health Plan contractors in our area, where we have a particular medication that we'd like to use, and we find out it's not covered, or it is covered, or we have to go through the prior authorization process. It sounds like it's obstructive, but it's really not. We're so used to that. We've been doing this since 93, so we've been doing this a long time and are used to that. We as a medical society would actually like there to be one state formulary. That's not part of this bill at all, but it would make our life so much easier than they have multiple formularies, what's covered, what isn't covered. But the bottom line is that what I see a patient when I'm prescribing a medication, I want to know what's right for the patient, for the indication, I want what's safe, and then also what's going to be covered by the particular plans. And as we know, we all live within budgets, whether you're a commercial insurance carrier, whether it's the Oregon Health Plan, or in this situation, DMAP. And so we would like, you know, and support the idea that, in fact, DMAP should have the same rules and the same processes that are in place as applicable to the other insurance carriers.
Okay. Question? Yes.
Dr. Lace, when you call in for prior authorization and you're looking at a patient and you're trying to select a drug, on what basis, and this is kind of an elementary question, but I'll get to my point, on what basis do you select that particular drug for that particular patient?
You want to hear the really bad side of that? It's because sometimes we're in the habit of prescribing things. We've been detailed by the pharmaceutical companies. We've learned to use a particular medication for whatever reason. It's not always evidence-based like it should be. And so you do it sometimes out of force of habit. You've got time constraints and everything else. When somebody calls up and says, hello, do you know that there's some alternatives, there's some other options out here? And by the way, our insurance company covers this, and the patient is going to have a $50 or $100 copay for a similar medication. We'll say, oh, okay, sorry. We didn't realize that. And so in the, not, I hate to say the speed of things that go on in private practice, but there are time constraints. And so typically it's out of force of habit. And so I actually don't mind when somebody says, well, we're not going to cover that, or are you aware of this? It also requires me to review that. And so we like evidence-based reviews, of which the Oregon Health Resources Commission does very well. And so when they come and we have that, and we could actually use that, like I said, for a host state formulary, that refreshes my memory. And just like Senator Mona Sanderson said, it's very, very hard to keep up on everything. I got 5 different things that I subscribe to on medications, but I don't always have recall on those. And so if I have to go through the PA process, I don't look on that as a hardship at all. We do that. We have people on our staff that just do it all the time. And like I said, we started doing this about 93 when we started really doing managed care. So to us, on the front line in primary care, it doesn't represent a hardship.
So follow up, Mr. Chair. So I have to presume from what you've said then is that usually the evidence-based drug is far cheaper than the drug that you might be prescribing in order for me to get this $8 to $34 million savings.
It could be. It doesn't always have to be. But typically, if there's a cheaper alternative that's out there that works just as well, then yes, we can do that. But I don't actually look. Typically, my first question is not the cost of the drug. The patient may come back on a commercial carrier, for example, and say, you know, I have a $100 copay on this. Can you prescribe something that's cheaper? Then the cost comes in. My first thing is, what's the diagnosis? You know, what are my usual list of medications that I use for whatever reason? And those are the ones that I reach for first. And then the patient will come back and say, did you know? And I'll say, whoops,
or I'll get a call back from the nurses or through the different carriers that say, hey, you know, we don't cover that one, and we have these alternatives that appear to be just as effective. So cost is not my first actual choice. It's you coming in with a medical condition, gosh, here's what I think is best, and I may get corrected. We do this on the hospital side all the time. Hospital pharmacies review that. The pharmacist will call me up and say, did you know, or, you know, this dosage doesn't seem right. And I welcome those reviews because I don't want to make a mistake, and I want to do what's best for you.
One more follow-up, yes, Mr. Yes. Chair. So am I to presume that on this drug that they're going to tell you, on the ones that save the money, are they generic drugs?
I am not qualified to answer that question. I would assume that some of these may be generic, but you have to realize sometimes there are some conditions for which there are no generic drugs. And it's like, okay, that's the only one that works, and that's the only one we're going to be able to use for this condition, and so there is no alternative. The generics may be used on a particular condition if they're available, but they're not always available. And there's the other thing to remember is this. My understanding of the bill is that's not going to stop ongoing therapy. If you're already on a specialized medication and you have some, you know, special indication for it, they're not going to pull the plug on you and say, "Oops, we're going to put you on a different medication." You, like I said, they're going to grandfather in, and these are going to be the new medications, the new starts, if you will, and be looking at some alternatives that could be cheaper.
I see.
How do drugs get on the formulary aside from being evidence-based? Let's say there are three drug companies that have a similar drug.
Mm-hmm.
The one that gives you the best price will be on the formulary. Is that?
Well, this is the darker side. You know, if you talk about rebates, you talk about, you know, yeah, how, whatever word you want to use, the commercial insurance will go through large suppliers. And they will have medications that they will get in bulk, and they'll be cheaper. And how all those things play out, you know, how does the insurance company save money when they offer you a particular plan? That's individualized in within the plans, and I don't want to speak for them.
Okay.
But I know that exists, and they call rebates, mm-hmm, you know, however you want to do that. That's, you know, where you pay so much money and you think you should have everything, but in fact, there's things that go behind the scenes, okay, and so that's just,
well,
that's the business of medicine.
Well, I should not have asked you that question. I'll ask somebody else, because it seems to me that if there are three drugs of equal value from three different companies, and there's a kind of a bidding war, and it brings down the price, and the price is not because it's a, well, the cheap price, it has nothing to do with the quality of the drug. I think it has to do with how badly they want to be on the formulary, because they don't sell a lot of drugs if they're on the formulary. If they're not on the formulary, they don't get to sell very many drugs.
Well, that's why we would like to have one formulary for the whole state. That's not popular.
Okay, we'll make a note of that, and we'll we'll get it in a minute. I don't think so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Jim Gardner, you've been back there smiling and frowning and nodding your head this way and that. Jim, Bill Dalton, and let's see, Stuart Newman. Please come up.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Pharma, and I apologize in advance for the deluge of paperwork I'm about to burden you with here, but I think you'll find some of it interesting, some of it kind of a trip down memory lane, and hopefully at least a bit of it enlightening. 2007 is a very special year. It is the 30th anniversary of the passage by the 1977 legislature of House Bill 2841, which created Oregon's open formulary law for fee-for-service Medicaid. For 20 of those 30 years, it has been my privilege to participate in the defense of Oregon's open formulary law against repeated attempts to reimpose a closed formulary system like that which existed in Oregon prior to 1977. And while it is certainly true that many states have abandoned a commitment to open access for life-saving pharmaceuticals for the poorest among us. Oregon has not. As in so many other areas of public policy, Oregon has chosen to fly with her own wings. It is said that those who forget the lessons of history are doomed to relearn them at great cost. And I brought with me and have distributed to you three items from the legislative history of the 1977 legislation that created Oregon's open formulary law. The first is the LFO analysis by Art Wilkinson. Some of you will remember Art. And it showed a projected savings from eliminating the bureaucratic costs associated with prior authorization. The effect on overall costs could not be estimated. However, as we shall see in a moment, we now know what Art Wilkinson could not have known in 1977. The effect on overall Medicaid costs of the Oregon system. The second document is the measure intent statement, a little bit like our SMSs today. And what I want to draw to your attention here is the remarkable statement that 95% of the exceptions requested by physicians were granted. And part of the rationale for the 1977 bill was that if 95% of the PA requests were granted, why not simply eliminate the bureaucratic costs associated with the process? And that, I suggest to you, is a rationale as valid today as it was 30 years ago. Finally, the statement in support by the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. What this statement demonstrates is that from the very beginning, this legislation was motivated not by the lobbying of pharma lobbyists like me, but by advocates for the public interest. Today, groups like NAMI, which oppose Senate Bill 160, stand on the shoulders of worthy predecessors like EMO a generation ago, who fought to improve access to prescription drugs for Medicaid patients. Now, much has happened in the Oregon Medicaid system since 1977. The Oregon Health Plan has been born. It has waxed and waned and may wax again. Managed care has become the preferred approach for delivering services to Oregon Medicaid enrollees. Part D of Medicare has transferred over 50% of the Medicaid drug spend to the federal budget. And the debate continues over how to achieve universal coverage. But one thing has remained constant. Oregon's historic commitment to open formulary access for fee-for-service Medicaid enrollees, with one tragic exception that I will discuss in a moment. And as I mentioned a moment ago, we are now, with the benefit of hindsight, in a position to answer the question that Legislative Fiscal Office analyst Art Wilkinson could not answer in 1977, the overall effect on Medicaid costs. And what I'm about to tell you may surprise you, but statistics, particularly statistics provided by the Kaiser Family Foundation, do not lie. An Oregon State Medicaid fact sheet that was prepared by the respected Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured shows unequivocally that Oregon's approach of heavy reliance on managed care to serve the Medicaid population, coupled with open formulary access for the residual FFS population, has resulted in per-enrollee Medicaid costs that are 18% below the national average, or $3,345 for fiscal year 2003 for Oregon versus a national average of $4,072. And that's on the second page of this handout. Now, that's a remarkable achievement, and one of which Oregonians can be proud. It has truly been a win-win situation. Open access to prescription drugs has made care accessible to Oregon's Medicaid recipients without driving up overall costs. Now, how can this be, you might ask? You've heard the testimony today about how this would help reduce drug costs. Because, as study after study has shown, prominent among those studies, the Susan Horn study, formulary restrictions are correlated with overall health care cost increases because they tend, in general, to drive up hospitalization and outpatient physician costs. The gross savings, I want to note, in this particular bill, and you've heard the figure, 8 million, perhaps higher figures, the general fund gross savings is $3 million. That number you've been hearing is an all-funds number, which includes the federal funds. Now, let's take a closer look at the FFS fee-for-service population to see just what the impact of Senate Bill 160 would be. Because mental health drugs are carved out of HMO capitation rates for the Oregon Health Plan, a major effect would be to institute a closed formulary for mental health drugs. And I don't think anyone disputes that. I think that was the testimony already. This chart, and I have a color version and you have a black and white one, I think. It shows the top 40 fee-for-service drugs. In addition to mental health drugs, they include hemophilia treatments, epilepsy treatments, asthma treatments, among others. But the official description of policy option package number 103, which is the governor's policy package that's associated with this bill, makes it clear that what OMAP is after, above all, is imposition of a prior authorization regime on mental health drugs. One of the remarkable statements in that official analysis is this: a PA-enforced PDL, including mental health drugs, increases prescription drug savings in two ways. First, it increases the utilization of the preferred drugs that have been found to be the most cost-effective, while also judged to be efficacious based on a review of the clinical evidence available. Now, that statement assumes that an evidence-based review has been conducted of mental health drugs pursuant to the practitioner-managed prescription drug plan. But, of course, it has not, since the legislature in 2001 wisely chose to carve mental health drugs out of the PMT process. So we have no idea what a future review would look like or what the complexities of these two drug classes, antidepressants and antipsychotics, what kind of a product you would get. But the error goes further. In fact, the Health Resources Commission did conduct two very thorough medical technology assessments of mental health drugs in 1999 in response to, you guessed it, an attempt to impose a prior authorization regime on fee-for-service mental health drugs, an attempt that, I should add, was rejected by the legislature. And I can, they're a little bulky, so I didn't make copies of them, but these are the two studies from 1999 for antipsychotic drugs and antidepressant drugs. The conclusion of these two MedTAP reviews, which predated the PMPDP, were clear and unambiguous. State-of-the-art mental health medications should be prescribed as first-line therapies. That's what the evidence showed, according to the experts who sat on those panels. Now, I'm all for saving money, but there are penny-wise and pound-foolish ways to save money. And I mentioned the tragic exception that I was going to get to in just a moment, a little while ago. And that's the tragic case of Douglas Schmidt, who vividly illustrates the penny-wise, pound-foolish approach. As the Oregonian noted, on November 19, 2003, Doug Schmidt died at the age of 37 as a consequence of ill-conceived cuts in the DHS budget. In this case, it was the temporary elimination of the Medically Needy program, which many of you will remember. He suffered a massive seizure after DHS decided, pursuant to a legislative decision, that it could no longer afford to pay a few dollars a day for his epilepsy medications. As a consequence of DHS's penny-wise, pound-foolish decision, Schmidt spent the last 8 months of his life unconscious and severely brain damaged, and the bill to DHS for his hospitalization totaled about $1 million. You will note on the list of top 40 FFS drugs, there are three epilepsy drugs. Now, if you can conceive of a situation where through a bureaucratic glitch, through a delay in a phone message getting through, or through a physician simply being too busy to make that call to get the particular drug the physician thinks is appropriate, a seizure occurs, I suggest to you that in three or four or five instances, you would quickly blow through the anticipated savings that are associated with Senate Bill 160 and very easily run into the red. Are there better ways to save money in the DHS budget? Some of them, like the polypharmacy program, which attempts to isolate people receiving more than 15 drugs, I think some of you are familiar with. Some of those were our ideas. Some of them were other people's ideas. And they have worked, not perfectly, but they have certainly worked to save money. But there is a more dramatic alternative.
Excuse me just a minute. The case that you cited of the gentleman who died as a result of not getting the medication was a result of budget cuts.
It right? was.
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
It wasn't a result of getting the wrong medication.
What I'm suggesting to you, Mr. Chairman, is that if you have an instance where, for whatever reason, prior authorization is not granted for a drug that's necessary to deal effectively with a medical condition, you could run into a situation where hospitalization occurs, physician outpatient occurs, that could quickly overwhelm the savings, the gross savings associated with a prior authorization system.
But the instance that you mentioned had nothing to do with prior authorization.
It did not. It had to do with a program cut.
Okay. Okay. Just be sure that we understand.
The suggestion that with some hesitation I bring to the committee's attention as an alternative was actually made not by Pharma but by the Oregonian in a survey, in an article where they were attempting to look for budget opportunities in the DHS budget. The Oregonian reported that Oregon ranked ninth among the 50 states in the number of state human services workers per capita, and they made the following factual determination. Oregon has twice as many, and I'm quoting now, Oregon has twice as many workers per capita as the national average performing the core functions of the Department of Human Services based on the way the Census Bureau categorizes state workers. If the state cut back to the national rate, including trimming the 1,000 central administrative jobs in the department, it could save $100 million a year. Not my numbers, the Oregonian's numbers. I urge you to reject Senate Bill 160. In doing so, you will honor the memory of your predecessors who sat on this very committee 30 years ago. Those legislators a generation ago did something brave and honorable for Oregon's neediest citizens. They cut bureaucratic costs and provided open access to life-saving prescription drugs. And in the process, as the Kaiser Family Foundation statistics show, the resulting overall per enrollee Medicaid costs in Oregon are significantly below the national average.
Were you in the legislature at that time?
I was, Mr. Chairman, I was not.
I was going to ask you how you voted on that bill.
It was, Mr. Chairman, luckily it was already in effect when but I did serve on that committee under the able chairmanship of your predecessor, Bill McCoy.
Thank you.
Yes.
Did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Monsanto.
Thank you.
Monsanto.
We have 600,000 Oregonians that don't have health insurance. And if we were able to save $20 million, that, especially if we get go toward more getting more people onto the Oregon Health Plan, in a sense, don't you think then that we'd have more health care and actually probably more uninsured getting drugs that they wouldn't ordinarily get onto? Have you ever looked at how much money pharma gets for every person we put back onto the Oregon Health Plan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz-Anderson, I have not looked at the latter statistic. But certainly, our industry, like many others, thinks that the proper way to go is to move toward coverage for everyone. What I want to caution you, though, is that it's important to be solicitous of special needs of the people who are, particularly those receiving mental health drugs, that are on fee-for-service Medicaid. It's a delicate population, and it cannot only, if they don't get the right drug when they need it, it cannot only have terrible personal effects, but it can also run up the budget, which is a self-defeating, penny-wise, pound-foolish approach that I don't think is going to take us toward universal coverage.
Now, it was my understanding, it's my understanding that those disorders that are above the line, like schizophrenia, there's definitely not going to be a problem with prior authorization.
Madam Chair, Senator Moniz-Anderson, I heard that testimony today, too. But then the question arises, if they're automatically going to grant it, why are we doing this? That was the question in 1977. And I think an honest answer, and you heard it honestly expressed, and it was by one of the prior witnesses, it was called the sentinel effect. What that really means is, I'll translate that. What that means is, if you create a kind of bureaucratic hassle for the physician that takes his or her precious time, you're going to create an incentive not to make that call. And that's the real dirty little secret, if you will, of a program like this. It's not that they will routinely get denied. It's that the doctor will be discouraged, disincented from calling at all because it just takes too much time.
Just a follow-up?
Yes.
I really don't think that this is going to be a problem for those life and death type situations with the severe mental health disorders. I think that probably there is more for more of those drugs, and I don't know exactly which disorders, but probably more for depression, where there's so many different drugs, and especially those that are advertised on the TV. To be able for a physician to be able to have evidence based on those types of drugs rather than those that would actually cause death, because I can't imagine a physician would ever not give a medication that wasn't appropriate for a patient.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz-Anderson, one would certainly hope not, though you will notice that all of the assurances that have been offered by OMAP, we're always going to grant the PA, we're not going to apply it to HIV/AIDS or cancer drugs. Those assurances are conspicuous by their absence from the bill itself.
Thank you. Who wants to go next?
Why don't you go next?
Thank you, Jim.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Dr. Stuart Newman. I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm here to represent the Oregon Psychiatric Association. You'll have to forgive me. This is the first time I've testified like this. I didn't bring graphs or anything like that. I wanted, I think, to speak to you folks about what I do as a psychiatrist, what my colleagues in the Oregon Psychiatric Association do every day, and where this hits home. And that's in how we practice medicine as physicians. I'll be the first to admit that oftentimes psychiatry becomes more of an art than a science. And I love the fact and applaud the fact that we're talking about evidence-based practices here today, because that's something that when I started my training 6 years ago was the newest thing. And I appreciate that it's permeated to the point that in a public forum like this we can be talking about it. However, what we're also talking about is someone coming into my office in some type of way and assisting me in practicing the medicine that I've spent my lifetime training to perform, to practice, and to assist me in treating the patients that I see. I'm the one seeing these patients. These patients are in my office. I'm getting to know these patients. I'm getting to know their families. I'm getting to know their history. And I have a problem with that. We're talking about savings, and we all know that healthcare in this country is exceedingly expensive, and I applaud the efforts to reduce those costs. However, as the gentleman who spoke before me talked about, there are times when looking at one saving makes us blind to the costs that those savings may incur. Now, I'm going to talk specifically about the psychotropic medications, the medications used to treat psychiatric disorders. But this is, at its core, an effort to change my behavior in some type of way. It's an effort for me to use a different medicine, a less expensive medicine, or a medicine that can be obtained less expensively. Now, in many cases, there's no real reason why I wouldn't do that. I appreciate that. And Senator, you just mentioned that in some way this may be an effort to inform clinicians about the evidence-based practice that's out there, the evidence-based medicine that's ongoing. And I agree with you, but at the same time, that's my job. My job is to be familiar with that evidence, and my job is to apply that evidence to the singular individual who sits in my office, that unique individual with their unique circumstances and their unique chemistry. Evidence-based medicine takes us so far, but at the end of the day, it's the individual sitting in the chair across from me in the office that I'm responsible to. And in many cases, that's where these types of programs fall down, because they don't take into account those things. Now, I could go into a lot of technical detail and tell you about various kinds of drugs that are available generically, that are not indicated for treatment or adjunctive treatment, that will never get evidence-based medicine done on them because no one cares. No one's going to pay for that study because it's not lucrative for anyone to do it. So where do they fall? And I've used those medicines, and I've seen people recover by using those medicines. Additionally, I'm in a final year of training. In the year that I've done this training, I've stepped out of my role, my primary role, as I see it, as a child psychiatrist, to do some additional training. And in this year's time, there have been 4 or 5 new medications that have come on the market. Medicines for indications that I treat as a child psychiatrist. Medicines that I don't have any experience with. That this formulary will have no experience with. Medicines that I've already talked to colleagues about, and I know that work in certain circumstances, for certain patients. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about allowing doctors like myself, like my colleagues at the OPA, to do our jobs, and that's to treat the patients that sit in our offices. To not have to make phone calls. I would love it if all I had to do was make a phone call. And they'd say, fine, Dr. Newman, use that medicine. But if that's the case, why am I making a phone call? I'm
I'm failing to understand that. If it's to have a discussion for 5 or 10 minutes with another professional about other options, I'll do that. I'll go down the hall if I have questions. I have colleagues in my office I can talk to who do the same thing that I do every day. I don't need to talk to someone in an office somewhere. But if I have to do that for half the patients that I see, if I can see 15 or 16 patients a day, I got to make 8 phone calls. I got to spend 10 minutes on the phone for each of those. I could be seeing a lot more patients that day. And that's what I'm here to do. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Do you deal with any formularies at all in your practice?
Yes, I do.
Tell me about the formularies that you deal with. Tell me about how they work.
Well, in training, I worked at the Veterans Administration Hospital, which has a large formulary system. We were given algorithms, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
When a patient comes in with this type of symptom or this type of diagnosis, this is the medicine you start with.
Mm-hmm.
And when they fail this medicine, this is the medicine you go to. And following that, these are the medications that are then available. Because the issue was cost. And there were concessions made that there are studies that have shown that these are equi-efficacious for various patient populations. But again, some of this is more art than science. We're talking about a given patient with a given set of symptoms or a given set of comorbid symptoms who may benefit from a medication that's more activating as opposed to sedating, or vice versa, where it's not that clear-cut. There are other issues.
What other formularies do you deal with besides the Veterans Hospital? Do you have other experience with formularies?
I've worked in the Department of Corrections, who have a formulary system, and I've worked with managed care organizations, also who have formularies.
So do you have a problem with managed care organizations and their formularies? Do you have to call in for pre-authorization?
Very few of them actually allow you to call in. The vast majority actually ask for paperwork. I'm filling a form out, and I'm trying to create the case, if you will,
mm-hmm.
for why the medicine that I want to use for this given individual, for this given diagnosis, is under their formulary rules acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've tried 3 other medicines that are effectively the same type of medicine. So why do we have to go through 3? I did one. It didn't work out. I'll do a different one. That doesn't work out. My clinical judgment, my training, the evidence base says, move on. They're asking me to do yet again another trial.
Okay. So as far as you're concerned, formularies are not good medical policy.
Yes.
Okay. Are those evidence-based, or are they just formularies based on cost? Now, I don't know that the low price of the pharmaceutical is because it's a cheap drug to start with. I think there could be a high-priced drug that they have to lower to get on the formulary, but were the other formularies evidence-based?
I don't know. I don't know how those formularies are determined.
Do you value evidence-based?
Excuse me?
Do you value evidence-based medicine?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So this would... Okay. Other questions?
Yeah. I thought you fell asleep.
I was just waiting for the dialogue.
No.
Very interested in the discussion and taking active notes.
Good afternoon. My name is William Dalton. I live here in Salem. I don't know if you need to know my address. I'm not here with any particular group. I do have a PhD in psychology. My focus was not clinical, but I worked in administration, and so I was living in an environment of clinicians and consumers most of my professional life. Been a professional community mental health administrator for about 25 years of my life. In fact, I've appeared before Senator Cruz on a number of occasions. I like to think of myself as an advocate. I was always interested in the consumer foremost and supported my staff to take those kinds of approaches. I'm an active taxpayer, having just filed my returns, I can tell you that. But maybe most importantly for today's purposes, in light of the eloquence of Dr. Newman and Mr. Gardner in terms of sharing their perspectives, maybe the most important hat I wear today is as a consumer. After decades of being what I hope was a fully functioning mental health professional, administrator, public health, mental community mental health, I suffered a bit of a meltdown. I don't know that despite all of the good services and consultation I've had, including lots of wonderful pictures of what's inside my skull, we can really pinpoint why I had that meltdown. But I can say thanks in a variety of ways, not only to the opportunity to be here today to share with you, but to the state of Oregon for allowing its state employees to have good health plans. My wife's been a longtime state employee, and as a result, I was the beneficiary of a very excellent health plan. I'm also very beholden to Blue Cross Blue Shield, which has been our provider of first recourse for quite a number of years, because Blue Cross Blue Shield has been marvelously flexible and has not been formulary-based and has been very open and, in fact, set a bit of a precedent here in the state of Oregon for allowing mental health recipients, mental health service recipients, to receive the same care as those receiving medical services, and I'm very thankful for that. Maybe I'm most thankful for the care that I've received most recently from a very excellent psychiatrist. And a lot of the testimony today, both in favor of Senate Bill 160 and against, if you will, raising questions about Senate Bill 160, hits home for me. If anything, I have been humbled over the past 10 years by recognizing, not just on a professional level, but on a very personal level, how individual we are, particularly when it comes to our brains. And when you talk about psychotropic medications, medications that are used to address mental health issues and problems, you're talking about some of the medications that are dealing with the most mysterious parts of our existence as human beings. I also am struck by the fact that I would believe it's a true statement to say that relatively few of us that are being treated for complex, long-term mental health problems are being treated with just one medication. And when I listen to the people who talk about formularies, and when I listen to the people who talk about evidence-based, I can tell you from my readings that there is a paucity of research based on how psychotropic medications interact with one another. It's just too complex a field. And as Mr. Gardner and Dr. Newman both pointed out, there are relatively few people who are out there going out of their way to pay for small portions of research. Most of the research has to do with a bottom line of monetary. And so I trust people like Dr. Newman to combine that art and science of serving me as a specialized medical practitioner. It's quite possible, frankly, if we had had to deal with formularies and go through, for instance, what some of the people go through apparently in the VA system, that I wouldn't be here today. Under the best of circumstances, maybe I just wouldn't be able to present myself to you in any cogent kind of fashion. Under the worst of circumstances, given what I've been through over the past 10 years, it's quite possible that I simply would not be alive to share my story and to feel so appreciative of the system that we have here in Oregon and the care that I've received. So I'm here, I guess, most specifically to raise in a very personal way, based on my own experience, a red flag of caution. I would expect there are times and places and circumstances and diagnoses under which formularies work very well. And having sat in front of numerous committees, and argued for how important funding is for mental health and public health services. I very dearly embrace any time that we can save money in our system, because as was so appropriately pointed out, those savings will increase both the depth and breadth of care that we can offer the citizens of Oregon. But if we talk about systems that raise bureaucratic barriers to our specialized caregivers to providing the very best care they can based on that acquaintance with the patient, based on their discussions that go on every day with their colleagues, based on their constant reviews of the most recent evidence-based results that are coming to their attention, and we try to substitute a call, maybe it isn't to Kansas City, maybe it's to Portland, but I did not hear in the initial presentation today anything to me that connoted a fellow specialized, trained, sensitive, patient-oriented professional picking up a phone because of a formulary requirement and talking to another fully trained, patient-oriented, specialized professional. I dare say it's a system that is going to dumb down the very thing that is keeping the consumers here in the state of Oregon out of hospitals, out of suicides, out of confrontations with police departments that lead to some of the worst kinds of things that we've read about in our local newspapers. So all I ask is, in the process of considering this bill, in the process of trying to figure out the very most sensitive, cost-effective basis of delivering care, that we don't go for promises of weapons of mass savings. We've been that route. Please do not shadow box with the welfare and indeed the lives of some of the most fragile citizens we have in the state of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was very good, compelling testimony.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Questions? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Yes.
I don't have a question, but I just have to say to Mr. Dalton, I am always amazed at people like you who have such courage to come forth and share with us, just simply for no other purpose but to help things be better. And I greatly, greatly appreciate that. I don't know that I could do it myself, and so I honor you for being able to be strong and to make quite a difference. Your testimony was powerful, and I want you to know how much it's appreciated.
Thank you. This was a bit of my coming out party, so I particularly appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. By the way, we're going to carry this bill over until next Monday. We're going to be out of here by 5. We have to be out of here by 5. Let's see. Okay, Dr. John Satisfield, something close to that.
That was pretty good, thank you, sir.
Okay. And Dean Huxby, if you could come up. Okay, we have 15 minutes. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Chair Morissette. My name is Dr. John Satinsville. I'm a family physician. I have actually been in private practice here in Salem until just about 9 months ago, when I left that line of work and became the senior medical director at LIPA. And I am here testifying on behalf of LIPA, which, as some of you may know, is a Medicaid managed care plan in Eugene, Oregon. We are fully capitated.
And you'll explain what LIPA means.
LIPA originally started out as...
Well, no, what is LIPA?
It used to be the Lane Independent Physicians Association, but right now we're just LIPA.
Oh. Okay.
But thank you. This is a fascinating opportunity, and I really appreciate the chance to testify before the committee. There are just really a few points that I would like to make. I think that we've heard a lot of stories, and I think we've seen a lot of smoke about formularies and how they're going to be disadvantageous to patients. And at least from the perspective of my 20-plus years in practice, I just don't buy that argument. The argument has been made about autonomy, about physicians' right to prescribe whatever they want and whenever they want. And I would simply point out to you that while that sounds very wonderful and very reasonable, and we would all like to believe that our physicians will always pick exactly the right choice of medication for us for exactly the right reasons, the truth of the matter is that marketing by large pharma works. When I was in private practice, I had usually very young, usually very attractive female pharmaceutical representatives in my office almost every day pushing their drugs. And they push them because they know that when they present them to physicians over and over again, they can impact the ability of physicians to write prescriptions, and that's what they want to do. The point being that prescribing choices on the basis of, on the part of physicians, are not always completely rational. They are driven by forces that go beyond just what is going to be the best, most effective treatment for this patient. And I think that the formulary as it's been described here, the implementation as it's been described here, would in fact assist us in reminding us that oftentimes what we need to do is take a quick moment and ask ourselves the question, is this in fact the most reasonable, cost-effective step to take for this patient sitting in my office right now at this time? I'd like to point out that the fully capitated health plans, of which I am a senior medical director, have used a formulary with prior authorizations from onset. We go through this every day. And what we find is that we meet with our formulary, our pharmacy and therapeutics committee, we establish the kind of algorithms that the psychiatrist was talking about, and we ask our prescribers to follow those algorithms because they in fact represent high quality care. The gentleman who was sitting here just before me commented about practicing in the VA with those algorithms, and I would like to point out that the VA healthcare system, with one of the tightest controlled formularies in the country, and they control that by means of those clinical algorithms, also delivers overall some of the best high-quality healthcare in the country and most cost-effective. Formularies, when they're designed properly, work extremely well. What we find is that the formularies help to reduce unnecessary prescriptions for costly medications when far less costly medications can be used. It allows us to be able to extend better quality, better breadth of benefits to more members by being able to save those pharmaceutical dollars that would otherwise go to big pharma and use them to buy basic health care services and generic medications for patients who really need them. Overall, bottom line is that full access to necessary medications will not be impaired by the prior authorization requirements that appear to be anticipated by this bill. The Health Services Commission will ensure that covered medications, that covered conditions under OHP will have access to medications to effective drug treatments, and that as those requirements for treatment change and medications that perhaps are not on the formulary are required, the process by which formulary authorization can be obtained is very, very minimally intrusive. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Okay. Would you like to go ahead?
Thank you, Senator Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Dean Haxby. I'm an associate professor of pharmacy with the Oregon State University College of Pharmacy, and I've been asked to present testimony regarding research we've done on the implementation of the first four classes of the preferred drug list back in 2002, and then also subsequent four classes that were implemented towards the end of 2003. And so we've actually evaluated this process and really found that when a soft prior authorization is used, it was very effective in terms of increasing the percent of prescriptions of that of those drug classes from 57% to 82% with that policy that was implemented. When we evaluated other drug classes that came in later after that policy was no longer in effect, there was virtually no change in terms of prescribing preferred agents compared to non-preferred agents. So the real conclusion of our research was that to really get meaningful change and prescribe the agents that are supported by the evidence and are the best value, you need to have something in place to encourage use of those preferred agents. So I'm trying to be brief here, Bobby. I've cited the Health Affairs article where details of the study are published, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm also on the Health Resources Commission. I'm very familiar with the process of developing the drug list.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. When developing the PDL, the fact that you knew a prescriber could prescribe anything, do you think that informed the creation of the list?
I don't think it really did at that point. Again, there's never been any policy or anything in place that, again, denies access to non-preferred agents. I think the goal was really to summarize the best available evidence on these drug classes and develop a report. That's really the primary role of the Health Resources Commission. That report then goes to OMAP to then make decisions in terms of the best available, most effective agents, and then other agents that are equally effective and comparably priced.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I get the reason, I think, is if we put a PA on top of the PDL, I think we'd find it probably a more restrictive list than a lot of other states that do have PA currently have.
What is a PDL?
Preferred drug list.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah. Have you done any preliminary work on mental health drugs, evidence-based research on mental health drugs yet?
The Health Resources Commission has been prohibited from reviewing those drug classes, although there has been.
March 12, 2000.
I thought it was party time.
There have been reports.
What are you on? I'm on Senate time.
Okay.
There have been drug classes reports, evidence-based drug class reports developed on those that other states are using. Oregon has not reviewed those because they're prohibited from. Those are excluded from the PDL process currently.
And that was my next question. Are there evidence-based research on mental health drugs being done in other states?
Yes, and there's preferred drug lists that are being enforced in other states in those particular areas. I don't have firsthand knowledge of exactly what's happening in those other states. Maybe other folks could comment on that.
Okay. I was just curious. I feel this is a whole new area that we need to be pursuing, and I was just wondering who was doing it in the United States.
I guess what I'm interested in is what experience has occurred in other states. I mean, what experience? What incidents may or may not have happened? How have other states, the 42 or so, functioned under a formulary, and have there been problems with the formulary? That's kind of what I'm interested in. Okay, we have one more person to testify, and then go ahead.
I have one quick question. One of the reasons that has been given to me over years is that the reason we have the difference in the cost of drugs and the generics is because of the research that's done by the pharmaceutical houses, and that's the reason they have to charge, because other countries don't do the research and so forth and so on. Having been involved in research, would you agree or disagree with that?
We could probably spend a couple hours talking about a lot of the process of pricing pharmaceuticals. It's a very convoluted process, and the fact is it's very difficult for
practicing clinicians to know what a drug actually costs because of the rebate process, things like that. The bottom line is that I think that the price is set based on what the market will bear. And if I think in the area of pharmaceuticals, it's very price insensitive to the price of the drug. There's many examples where high-priced agents that, in fact, may actually be inferior are being used extensively over much better established drugs simply because they're not being marketed.
There is a lot of research done on the cost, the amount of money spent on advertising versus the amount of money done on research by various pharmaceutical companies. And so there are two factors for the price of the drug. One is the marketing, the amount of money spent, and the amount of money returned because of the heavy marketing, and the amount of money on research. And so it's, you know, it isn't just the research that raises the cost, according to some studies. Angela, you're going to get the final word.
Well,
I'm glad,
like
I'm glad you wrote me the note. You're going to be gone next week. We're going to continue this hearing next Monday, and we will continue with the list that we have. Go ahead.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here as a representative of not only NAMI National, but also NAMI Oregon. And I'm grateful that you give me a few minutes because, as I mentioned in a note, I will be out of state next week, so I won't be able to attend. And I want to give a little bit of context, and that's, you know, over a century ago, Oregon was a pioneer in progressive care for those with mental illness. And Dorothea Dix, who was an advocate back then, came to Oregon to examine Dr. Hawthorne's hospital in Portland and declared that it was one of the finest examples of compassionate care in this nation. And later, Oregon chose to build the Oregon State Hospital, a public institution, in an effort, according to the historians, to lower the cost of care. And thus began a downward spiral of neglect, as those with mental illnesses were abandoned to slowly decaying facilities and inadequate resources for care. Today, I would like to thank the committee members and this legislature for working to change the course of how Oregon treats people with serious mental illness. And as Oregon seeks to return to our once proud heritage, it is distressing to me to be here today to hear a state agency propose a bill that would put burdens on those who have serious mental illness, all to save money. SB 160 seeks to require prior authorization of payment for all medications not on the practitioner-managed preferred drug list. And mental health medications were specifically carved out of the preferred drug list for a reason. They were carved out with what the Medicaid, Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured issued a report in 2003 specifically recommending that state Medicaid plans carve out psychotropic medications. And there's a reason for that. Those individuals who are on Medicaid and have mental illnesses are extremely vulnerable, and this is a population where the cost impact of denying access or ready access to the right medications at the right time are extremely costly and can be devastating. I'd like to remind the committee, too, that even the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in enacting the Medicare Part D benefit, specifically called on all plans to substantially cover all psychotropic medications, the antidepressants, anticonvulsants, antipsychotics. So that is the context in which you're working. There are groups around the nation calling for the carve-out of mental health drugs. And it's true, as people have mentioned earlier, that other states have enacted preferred drug lists and prior authorization. Those have been cost-cutting measures done throughout this country. And I'd alert you to the fact that the Department of Justice has just come out with a report last fall saying fully 60% of people in jails and prisons in our nation are there with mental health disorders. what is the impact of preferred drug lists and prior authorization for mental health drugs? I can tell you, it's a few blocks away. It's in our decaying state hospital, and it's in our criminal justice system. That is the legacy of neglect. That is the legacy of denying access to people who need medications. And I want to point out that in my role now with NAMI National, I spend time reading the research and meeting with psychiatrists, meeting with doctors who are describing what's happening at the National Institutes for Mental Health. And I could tell you this. The National Institutes for Mental Health are coming out with press releases specifically stating that mental health drugs are different. The state of research in mental health medications is still in very preliminary stages because we have not invested in that research the way we needed to. And as a result, what they say is that every person reacts to medication on a very individual basis. These medications, even within classes, are not interchangeable. Every antidepressant, every antipsychotic works on different neurotransmitters. And we know that the impact on every individual can be profound. And I want to remind you that when people talk about saving money by putting people on drugs that are equally effective, I have to tell you that effectiveness is not clearly defined for mental health drugs in current studies. For example, the CADI studies studied only adherence to medication in a very finite number of symptoms in order to determine effectiveness of a medication. But with somebody who has schizophrenia, there are positive symptoms, hallucinations, delusions. There are negative symptoms, apathy, withdrawal, inability to connect with the world. There are mood symptoms, like depression, and there are cognitive symptoms, like ability to concentrate, ability to reason, ability to follow through or understand. All those symptom groups combined together make up the reaction of an individual. There is no preferred drug list in this nation that is looking systematically at that entire combined cadre of symptoms. And in fact, most of the studies that have been done have specifically ignored the population of clients that I'm most concerned about and those who are those clients most severely impacted. For example, in the CADI studies, those individuals who have tardive dyskinesia were specifically excluded from the studies. And what that is a serious movement disorder. And some of your own staff, Barry Cass, who used to be at the Department of Human Services, is now retired, once told me of a phenomenal trip he took to China as part of a healthcare mission. And he came back and he told me he was astonished in touring their psychiatric hospitals because patients there were on the older generation of antipsychotics and medications. They had the movement disorders. They were shuffling. They were drooling. That is an impact of saving money. I would also like to point out, too, that my son is taking several medications. One of them is medication Risperdal that works very well for him in low doses. It is scheduled to go generic in a relatively short time. It'll be phenomenally tempting for state agencies to put that on a preferred drug list because it'll be cheap. But I can tell you this. While that medication is helpful for my son, I hardly want to tell you the side effects that occur for other people. I have a good friend whose son took that same medication, and because it has lactation effects, he grew breasts. That's not what you want a 17-year-old boy who's suffering from bipolar disorder already to have to endure. It is a reason that psychiatrists tell me they would not necessarily prescribe a medication for a particular person because there are groups of side effects that raise your alarms for particular individuals. In addition, somebody alluded to earlier, that there are both sedating effects to some medications and there are stimulating effects to some of these medications. So a psychiatrist who works in a walk-in clinic in Portland told me if somebody, pardon me, if somebody walks in and they are all jazzed up and can hardly sit still and concentrate, the last thing he wants to do is prescribe a medication that's going to elevate that person and hype them up more. He wants something with a sedating effect. In addition, those who work in inpatient facilities have entirely different needs. Because of an acute setting, physicians often want something that works very quickly, where somebody who works in the community wants something that somebody's going to adhere to and be able to take over the long term. So the end note for all this are that these medications have been excluded for very, very significant reasons.
Now, are you saying that the evidence-based formulary that the state would come up with for mental health drugs, it falls into the category that you're talking about? All of the wrong drugs are going to be evidence-based on the formulary?
Chair Morissette, what I would say is I have no clear picture, nor is it in legislation, of exactly how that evidence-based review would occur.
Now, you travel in other states, right?
Yes, I do.
Do you travel in other states with psychotropic drugs on formularies?
Chair Morissette, yes, I do.
Would you please bring back some data from those states and tell us how it works?
And, Mr. Chair, one comment, too. You are absolutely right when you say we have not invested in research on mental health drugs. And that's why I am sort of surprised that you would not want Oregon to start investing in evidence-based research, because finally Oregon will be able to take these medications, look at them, and see. And you're absolutely right. Individuals react differently, but that's all a part of what's going to come out in evidence-based research. So I'm as passionate about evidence-based research for mental health drugs as you are against, it seems.
We have to go.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Evidence-based doesn't work for mental health drugs, pure and simple. We crafted, and I want to thank Angela for her testimony, we crafted 414.336 the way we did for a reason, and she spoke to it. It shouldn't be changed.
Thank you. We will be back again sometime.
Okay, is 414
Pardon me?
Eliminate
yes.
Mental health drugs?